Hello and welcome to Broadway Videos. This week on Broadway for Sunday, February 26, 2017. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a theater journalist and historian with a number of books. His most recent is The Great Parade, which is available everywhere. His columns appear at MTI, Masterworks Broadway, Broadway Select, and many of the places. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael is a theater reviewer and essayist whose work appears at Talkin' Broadway, Everything Sondheim, and Broadway Stars. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
With us today, we have a very special guest joining us by telephone. Karen Mason is with us. Karen has starred on Broadway, off-Broadway television, and in the recording studio. Broadway fans will know her from such shows like Wonderland, Hairspray, Mamma Mia, Sunset Boulevard, Jerome Robbins Broadway, and Play Me a Country Song. We're going to have to talk about that, get some details on that one. So, Karen, thanks for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm always happy to get up on a Sunday morning and not have to go to church.
Well,
You just lost so many listeners.
Anyway. I know. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, we've seen it.
We got a lot of fundamentalist Christians in this podcast. So, you know.
Hey, listen, everybody understands not having to get up on a Sunday and get dressed.
Now you're talking. The fact that you're saying that you would get dressed for church got them all back. Yes.
Yes, exactly. You know, Michael, Peter, and I wear, in celebration of Sunday morning, we wear our Sunday best hats. So, but since
I'm sorry, I don't have picture of that.
It's all for the best.
Yeah, it's all, exactly. So, Karen, thank you so much. I understand that you are just recovering from a playbill cruise.
I have to say, we're still in that kind of Logi, gee, I was on a cruise and I'm still on vacation head. It was fantastic. We had such a great time. They do good parties there at Playbill.
And where did you cruise?
Yeah, it was an incredible group of people. My first cruise was last year, and I was a little reticent, I have to admit, about being on a ship with an awful lot of people who were basically thinking only, you know, of theater, but it was absolutely fantastic. It was so much fun. And this year was even better. There were more performers, a lot of Andrea Martin was there, and Alice Ripley, Lilias White, Judy Kuhn, John McDaniels. I mean, it was Louise Pitre. It was actually a lot of my life was on that ship.
Yeah.
And it was so much fun. Paul and I got off the ship once over a week. We just, you know, it was in the Caribbean, and it was lovely just to stay on the ship and be in the sun.
Well, that is great. And you got a little rest and relaxation in and some good weather in time to come back to do a concert at Birdland on March 6th. So tell us about the concert.
Oh, I'm so excited about this. About a year ago, I did an Indiegogo campaign to raise money to finish a CD called It's About Time. And the title track was written by Paul Rolnick and Shelley Markham. And this is going to be the celebration of that CD. The release date is March 3rd, and we're doing the party at Birdland, the celebration on March 6th at 7 p.m. And, you know, it's been about 9 years since I did my last CD. And as we get older and time seems to get shorter, I said to Paul, we have to just keep making CDs. I love making them. They may be dinosaurs in some way, but I do love the process of compiling the songs, singing them in the studio, and having the musicians come in. That sense of collaboration has always been really exciting to me. And doing the show at Birdland, my music director of 25 years is going to be out of the country, selfishly. And so I had to find somebody else to play. And luckily, I found the incredible Ted Firth, who's going to do this show with me. Boy, is that young man, and I know he would probably argue that phrase, but that young man is so brilliant. And I'll have at the on bass and drums will be the gentleman who played on pretty much all of my CDs, most of them, is Bob Ranino on bass and Rex Benincasa on drums.
And your show is going to be directed by Barry Kleinbord, whom I ran into on the street yesterday.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, I'm meeting him tomorrow to talk about the show and all that, you know, interstitial patter that one has in cabaret. Yeah, Barry and I have worked together also about 20 years. And I totally rely upon his insight and his daring sometimes to put songs together. He's so smart about that.
I just want to...
I was just going to say also, my husband, Paul Rolnick, who wrote It's About Time, is going to be doing a couple songs from his new CD. And so we'll sing a duet together, a very, loving, sweet, very beautiful love song that he wrote called Shoot for the Moon. So it's going to be a great show. I'm so looking forward to it.
I thought you were going to say you two were going to sing You're Nothing Without Me from City of Angels. You should
well,
do
mentally,
that.
Well, mentally, that's what I'll be singing. But
so I was going to say before when you were talking about the cabaret was that you're a 12-time MAC Award winner, and most recently you won the Show of the Year and Celebrity Artist in 2016. So, I mean, you are keeping busy.
Yeah, well, you know, it distracts me from the Netflix shows that I like to watch. Yeah, listen, I feel very lucky that I was talking with someone on the ship about this, that sometimes it's more difficult for somebody who goes back and forth between theater and cabaret and any other, you know, concerts. Sometimes it's a little bit more difficult because people are not quite sure where to put you. And, you know, we're still in a very category-oriented mentality. Sure. And so, but I love that. I love that I get to go back and forth. And I'm always challenged and always finding new challenges and always being inspired by other people's work. And listen, you know, even as you get older, if you can continue to feel challenged and inspired, I think that's a good sign. That's for me, it's still, I hate the business part of it, but I love the performing and the collaborative part of it.
Well, I wanted to leap in and say before I forget, of course, Sunset Boulevard has been very much in the news lately. And someone somewhere posted a YouTube clip of Karen singing With One Look. If it's
this was not a relative.
Not a relative? Oh, not a relative post.
Of mine, yeah.
Right.
A disinterested observer posted it. And it's just fantastic. And someone posted this clip of Karen singing it to Alan Campbell. And every response was, oh, my God, I wish I had seen this. It's just so phenomenal. For some reason, it's in black and white, but it's very good quality picture and sound, and please look it up on YouTube. It's extraordinary.
I enjoy singing that song. I'm sorry.
Black and white is very appropriate for Sunset Boulevard. So
true.
True. So, for whom did you stand by? Was it Betty Buckley? Was it Glenn Close from the beginning? What?
I stood by for all three of them in the States. I started with Glenn Close out in Los Angeles, and then moved to New York with it, and so covered Glenn, Betty, and Elaine Page. And it was I stayed with it until almost the last 2 or 3 months. I got the reason I left was because I got offered to go to Japan with the New York Pops to sing with them for New Year's Eve, and I think they knew that they were coming down to the end and didn't want to necessarily offer an awful lot of privileges to people. And so I said, I've had three great years. Thank you very much. I'm going to Japan. I really wanted to be in to do that job. And so it was very amicable. And the beautiful Maureen Moore stepped in and the cover.
Yeah, she's terrific. Let me ask you, given the fact that so many of us, including me, has never done a Playbill cruise, can you tell us what it's really like for the people who pay money and go? What do they see? What do they do?
Well, they get every night there is a different performer, a different Broadway, Judy Kuhn, Brian Stokes Mitchell, Alice Ripley, myself, Howard McGillin. I know I'm forgetting someone. Louise. And every night they get a different Broadway star. And then while you're on the ship, you bump into them all the time. You get to talk with them. You get to ask questions. And Seth Rudetsky was also on this cruise, and I think he's been part of it from the very beginning, and does his chatterbox with he did afternoon chatterboxes with everybody. And you get to hear stories about being in the business that you don't normally get a chance to hear, and then also talk with the person right after it, or take them to dinner, have drinks with them. You know, it's very much a mix. Everybody mixes with each other, and it's just very relaxed and wonderful. I mean, you can go up to somebody that you've admired and just start a conversation, and you won't have a security guard coming after you.
Stage
door guy.
Let me also ask, given that Seth was asking you questions, did you divulge that wonderful name of that restaurant where you used to be a hostess when you were just starting out?
Why, yes, I did, Peter. It was
Tell
Lawrence
everybody.
Of Oregano's was the name of the restaurant.
Lawrence of
Oregano, pizza place, right?
Well, it wasn't pizza. It was Italian food.
I see.
It was upscale.
All right, a little more respect, a little more respect. I apologize. Yeah.
And they hired singing waiters and waitresses, and they wouldn't hire me as a waitress because I had no, not only experience, but skill. And so I got hired as a hostess. And my job was to, they put free pasta salad on everybody's plate. So my job, because I was a bad hostess also, by the way. Really bad.
That's meant to be.
And so my job was to walk around with this big vat of pasta salad and make sure everybody had a little bit on their plate.
Mm-hmm.
And then eat quite a lot of it, too, because it was quite good. And then to sing every once in a while. And that's where I met Brian Lasser, the gentleman I worked with, who basically changed my life for 16 years.
That's it's worthy of a 42nd Street revival. So back to It's About Time. The new CD has 14 cuts on it, various different shows that you've been involved with or roles that you've done. So let's talk about, you have the first one you've talked about with that Paul had written with Shelley, It's About Time, then Finding Wonderland from Frank Wildhorn, and Zing with the Strings of My Heart from James Hanley, and Everything's Coming Up Roses. So what made you put together this collection of particular songs?
I liked them.
Okay.
Seems to be good enough, yeah.
Yeah?
Thank you for your honesty.
You know, I'd like to say that there was this incredibly well thought out for, you know, we lost sleep over it. It's kind of, I picked out the ones I really thought sounded great, and because we recorded quite a lot of cuts. We, as a matter of fact, we're probably going to be releasing another CD within a year because we had so many that we wanted to choose from. Over the past years, I've been doing a lot of different shows and a lot of arrangements that I just love singing. And so when we were sitting down for this CD, you know, I mean, you have to have a certain number of big numbers and ballads, and we have quite a few power songs in, on this CD. But then, you know, we needed a few not in your face songs. So Finding Wonderland and I Can't Give You Anything But Love. And my favorite, though, I think, is What Are You Doing the Rest of Your Life? I just love that cut.
Mm-hmm. It's, but then there's all the Judy stuff. Talk about the Judy stuff.
You know, it's funny. Lorna Luft was on the Playbill cruise. Wow. And I didn't have the guts to tell her that because I really liked her. I got to know her a little bit and really liked being around her. And I thought I would just send my CD to her at some point. But I was asked to do a concert, a symphonic concert of Judy Garland songs and music and arrangements. And I just not only fell in love with all the arrangements again, but certainly listening to Judy Garland, you know, for a woman of my age and also a woman who has the type of voice that I have and does the type of singing that I have, you know, kind of landed on, she really is the master of that. And so to be able to listen to all of that and then sing those amazing orchestrations every night when those bongos would start for I'm going to love you like nobody. Oh, my heart just, it's a wonder I could sing at all. My heart just started going so fast. And so I really wanted to honor that inspiration and when including The Man That Got Away. Chris Denny did the arrangement of The Man That Got Away. And it's so beautiful. As a matter of fact, we'll be doing that at Birdland. It doesn't take anything away from the original intention. And it just makes it a little bit more, it simmers just a little bit more.
Karen, did you ever hear the wonderful backstory about the bongos in Come Rain or Come Shine?
No.
Supposedly. Rosemary Clooney had recorded a version of the song with the bongos. I think, is it Nelson Riddle?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because Rosemary Clooney had been very, very close with Nelson Riddle. And so he did it for her first, but it didn't become a huge hit. So then somehow Judy got it. And one night, Rosemary is at a Judy concert and she suddenly hears the bongos for Come Rain or Come Shine. And she's like, what's this? And so apparently she went backstage afterwards. And of course, Judy is receiving everyone backstage. And Rosemary's standing there like with her hands on her hips, like, Judy, what? What? And apparently Judy turned to her and said, Rosemary, darling, it's so great to see you.
And that was the end of that.
I love it. Listen, if you're going to steal, steal from the best. That's my motto.
I love that story.
So, yeah. Karen, you are gearing up for this March 6th event over at Birdland, and the CD is out and available right now, isn't it?
It is. It has not been actually released, but yes, it is. I mean, we've gone through all of the you can pre-order it on my website. You can pre-order it. I think it might be available soon on CD Baby. But the people, certainly the people who gave, you know, supported us in our Indiegogo campaign have hopefully all gotten their CDs. So we're chugging along. We will be selling them at Birdland, of course, and hopefully people will buy in bulk.
Well, yeah. So those folks can get over to KarenMason.com and check that out. And the concert is coming up March 6th. And we'll have links to Karen's website, also to Birdland, so you can get tickets to it and schedule your time over there and become a Masonite. And and I hear there's lots of Masonites around the world.
That's good.
You know, so yeah, if every single one of them just buys one CD, we're doing okay.
Heck yeah.
Karen, thank you so much for getting up on a Sunday morning and chatting with us on Broadway Radio. We really appreciate it.
All of my life with you.
Section, Michael and Peter got down to the Vineyard Theater to see Kid Victory, which is a John Kander show. What do we think about not having to say that automatic Kander and Ebb that that rolls off my tongue? It's just a John Kander show. So, Peter, why don't you start us off with Kid Victory?
It's a tough show, no question about it. One of my friends said it's the feel bad musical of the season. I think that's a little excessive, actually, because I think there's great worth in what's going on here. The music shows us that John has not lost a single iota of his talent. I find the lyrics certainly better than serviceable, maybe not memorable, but certainly solid, solid work from this young collaborator, Greg Pierce. Together, they came up with a story, and it's not a pleasant one. Of course, John has never shied away from controversial topics, be it in Cabaret or Kiss of the Spider Woman and plenty of others in between. But this one is particularly odious because it deals with a child kidnapping. Certainly, John's up to date because it's a story that couldn't have been written during many of the times when he was writing with Fred Ebb, because it deals with the internet, and it's one of those stories about a young man who meets somebody on the internet, becomes totally intoxicated with him, infatuated, perhaps in love, and goes to meet him. He doesn't realize this is a man who used to be a history teacher but was thrown out, probably for doing something similar to this, and he captures him and handcuffs him and keeps him for a long, long time. Much of the story deals with what happens after he is released, after the cops get on the trail of the kidnapper. And it's about readjusting. You don't forget about this and just go back to happy-go-lucky life, especially when you have parents who are extraordinarily religious. I wondered if there was a slight joke in the fact that early on, when you find out the mother who's very much a religious fanatic, allows deviled eggs in the house. I mean, that just struck me as a nice contrast, but it is mentioned, and I'm surprised that I think there might have been something more of that line than I might have thought. So Karen Ziemba is sensational as the mother who is just single-minded and fully expects that everything will go back to normal because, of course, God finds a way. Daniel Jenkins, it's nice to see them reunited after being in Bye Bye Birdie. Daniel Jenkins, who I really thought got robbed throughout his career, first off, for not getting a nomination for Big River when he was playing Huck Finn, because they eliminated the category that year because there weren't enough contenders. Though in 1995, they certainly found a reason to give Andrew Lloyd Webber a Best Score Award without anybody being in competition. Anyway, Daniel Jenkins also, I think, got robbed for Big, where I thought he was marvelous as well. So here he plays the father, who has a little bit more understanding than the mother, and he has a very nice song at the end. I will admit it reminds me of another song, but that's another story. So the boy tries to get back into real life. I mean, he tries to get a job. He gets one, and D. Ruscioli, I believe it's pronounced, turns out to be his employer, and certainly rolls with the punches that that happen while he's working for her, and he tries to do the best he can. She's tremendous as well. It's a terrific, terrific cast. And let's not overlook Jeffrey Denman, who usually plays a happy-go-lucky song and dance man, but here he shows us that when he's asked to play, let's face it, a pervert, he's able to find a way to do it. And he has both that appealing nature that some of these people have and that dangerous nature that can turn on a dime. There's a moment when he barks at the boy, "You never say no to me, never." And it's so chilling. So, well, time to talk about the boy, Brandon Flynn. I think this is the performance really deserves tremendous praise and tremendous awards. Ben Platt has been getting a lot of press for what he's doing in Dear Evan Hansen, and it's a similar role in many respects. And I think Brandon Flynn does it much more honestly and much more potently. So if you like Ben Platt and Dear Evan Hansen, I think you're going to be even more impressed with Brandon Flynn, who's not the least bit actory in what he's doing. So he really is giving a wonderful, real performance. So I think this is a tough show, but I think these guys set out to write a tough show, and I think they succeeded.
All right, Michael, what did you think?
Well, except for the very last statement, I agree with every positive thing that Peter just said. I think that John Kander is extraordinary. He has this incredible ability to write music in traditional, I don't want to say older, traditional styles, to write songs in traditional styles and still make them not sound in any way derivative. And I think that's an incredible talent. And he just keeps doing it well into his 80s. I am really in awe of John Kander, and I was so impressed with the score of this show. From the opening number, which is a sort of a hymn-like number, but then there were many wonderful moments afterwards. There's a very beautiful song that the father sings to the son at the end. There was, I thought, a missed opportunity here. It's so interesting. We've discussed before how it can be very theatrical to have a character who either doesn't sing at all or sings just a little bit or sings maybe only at the end of a musical. In this show, Brandon Flynn as Luke does not sing a note. And it seemed like it should lead to him finally singing at the very end when his father finally sits down and talks to him and basically says, you know, how are you doing now? What is going on with you right now after, you know, after this incredibly traumatic experience you've been through? And what we do see is then after Daniel Jenkins beautifully sings that song to Luke, the music continues, and then we see Luke beginning to open up, really opening up his heart. We don't hear what he's saying, but we see him really starting to talk with his father. And that was very effective, but I also thought that it could have – another decision might have been to have Luke sing the one song at the very end where we see that he's finally being able to express his feelings after this incredibly – traumatic thing that happened to him, but whatever. It's the fact that they're John Kander and Greg Pierce are playing with the form of musical theater and still experimenting, especially for John at his age, I think that is so laudatory and so impressive. I agree with about the cast entirely, and I did think that there were several problematic aspects in the story. There's one thing in the plot that I guess I can mention it. After Luke is finally freed or escapes from this captivity, and I won't say how that happens, at one point later he says, you know, there are times I almost wish I was back there. And I guess that's supposed to mean that his existence with his parents, and particularly his mother, is so oppressive in terms of the religious zealotry and how that does not fit in with the idea of him being gay. But I just thought, well, really, does that mean that it's so bad that you'd rather be back in a basement where you're sometimes actually chained to a wall? I don't know. I mean, maybe he had another option between those two things. So I wish he had expressed that differently. There are a couple of numbers that unfortunately I thought did not work at all. For some reason, the decision was made. There's a detective character, and he does like a vaudeville number that might be from Chicago. And then there's another character of another young man named Andrew, played by Blake Zolfo. And he comes on as a hookup for Luke through, some internet, whatever, it's Grindr or whatever. And he does a tap number. And I just thought, well, you know, I didn't think those two songs fit in with the other ones at all. I'm really surprised that they put them in, and I think they were both mistakes. I thought the rest of it, the tone was really quite wonderfully maintained throughout. And the final thing I'll say negative is that there were several moments when I was confused as to whether we were flashing back or forward, and it took me sometimes a couple of minutes to figure it out, and because of that I was taken out of the plot several times. But there's so much good in it that it's a very, very praiseworthy project, and I mean I have no idea if they intend to work on it further, but I almost kind of wish they would, because I think there's a great musical in there. It's just some problematic portions as well.
It reminds me a great deal. A lot of what you said reminds me a great deal of Manchester by the Sea, the movie that is up for an Oscar tonight and may win at least screenplay. But because there's a guy who can't get past what he's doing either. And in terms of the situation involving his saying, "I wish I were back there," there is such a thing as the Stockholm syndrome, so who knows how much that comes into play. But there's also an amazing moment that I don't want to give too much away about, but he has a moment where he talks about specifically where he could have gone home and chose not to. That's an amazing moment, an amazing speech. And it also points out, I know I'm being oblique here, it also points out how a turn of the head can make so much difference in a life. And if somebody doesn't turn a head at the right moment, the world changes for both parties. And if you want to know what I'm talking about, go see the show, which I think you should do anyway.
All right. So Kid Victory is down at the Vineyard Theater, 108 East 15th Street through March 19th, so you have a few weeks left to go check that out. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Next up, Peter and I got a chance to get down to the newly rechristened Broadway Theater, the Hudson Theater, to see Sunday in the Park with George. So, Peter, why don't you tell us about Sunday?
Yeah, it's wonderful to have it back. I find it terrific that Stephen Sondheim yet appears at another Broadway theater. He's certainly had his shows, or at least songs, in virtually all of them, and I think it's really fun and funny that this should open one of his shows should open the a new theater, and it wasn't supposed to be that way, you may recall, because there was talk of Burn This actually debuting the Hudson Theater, which hasn't had a Broadway show in it. It certainly has had conventions and parties, but it hasn't had a Broadway show in it as we know it since 1968. So Sunday in the Park with George, you know, I wonder, of the hundreds of songs that Sondheim has written, which took him the least amount of time, and I have a feeling No Life from this show was the one that did it. Not because it's one of his shortest. I checked. It's a minute 23 seconds. So it's not the brevity of the soul of wit that I'm talking about. I think it came naturally to him because he could easily relate to the situation of two mediocrities criticizing a genius's work, because he certainly had to deal with that throughout his life, where much of the public does not really respond to what he does. You might say, oh, wait a minute, wait, please. You know, I mean, look at all the awards he's had. Yeah, he has. Do you realize that Sondheim has never had a show that's run 1,000 performances? Mm. I mean, he's been on the scene 60 years, okay? I checked. 78 other Broadway musicals have reached 1,000 performances. Andrew Lloyd Webber, Stephen Schwartz, Alan Menken, and Jerry Herman have done it, and Kander and Ebb have done it three times at the very least, you know. So, and ironically enough, he has more Tonys. Sondheim has more Tonys than all of them put together. So, again, the cognoscenti and the critics and the awards givers understand Stephen Sondheim, but the people at large have proved by their not even being able to get a 2.5-year run, which is not an amazing run anymore these days. So I think this is the show that means the most to Sondheim. And I guess another piece of circumstantial evidence would be that when he put his lyrics in books, what did he title them? Finishing the Hat and Look, I Made a Hat. So that brings me to Jake Gyllenhaal, who is quite wonderful as Surratt. But he doesn't get the juice out of that line, Look, I Made a Hat, that Mandy Patinkin did in 1984. Because Mandy really had a marvelous way of putting down what he was doing. The way he showed the dog what he had been sketching, said, look, I made a hat, you know, like no big deal, before he realized, wait a minute, there was no hat there before I did it. And so it is an accomplishment. But Gyllenhaal tosses the line away, and as if it's not important as it is. And similarly speaking, Annalee Ashford throws away one of my favorite lines in Everybody Loves Louie, and that's about when she says, Louie drinks a bit, Louie blinks a bit. Sondheim is really good at those cruel observations of people, and this is one of his best. And she just throws it away as well. And yet, she's marvelous for the rest of it. So maybe I've just seen Sunday in the Park too many times, though I don't think that can be possible. Other than that, they're both great. But God is in the details, and I didn't get the little details that you get when you look at a pointillistic painting, I guess you could say, too. So under those circumstances, this is a very, very fine production. I liked very much the costumes, which were really eye-popping. And you say, okay, yeah, they have to be. You have to do that painting at the end of the first act. No, but they're beautifully done and beautifully made. You can tell that. So I think that's a big asset to this production. There's not much set. You don't expect it because, you know, this was born of a concert. So don't expect what you saw in 1984, but Beowulf Borat did do a solid job of what he was given to with his budget. The real revelation is in the second act, the Chromalume. Instead of that clunky machine that we always see, good Lord, what are they talking? You really will be dazzled by the way that the Chromalume is expressed. It's not going to be anything like you've seen before. And it really does indicate certainly a relationship with pointillism in a strange sort of way. So that's really what has always, to me, been a detriment to the second act is now an asset to the second act. And we've often heard that story about Sondheim being 15, writing a musical and bringing it to Oscar Hammerstein and hearing his mentor say that it was the worst thing I ever read. Now, what only occurred to me the other day was that show was called By George. But 39 years later, Sondheim did splendidly by George Surratt. He really did. He did a very good job. Supporting cast is wonderful as well. Certainly, Brooks Hismanskas is very funny, and so is Liz McCartney, both as the tourists who get to Paris and can't wait to get out of the place because they're just at sea at this very strange place. So I think they're quite successful. Very small roles, but they make them count, and I think that's always something that we're looking for, people who can make things count. Even well, the famous statement of there are no small parts, just small actors, which of course is much harder to believe now in grammar school and middle school situations where the leads get the microphones and the other kids don't. But so I like them tremendously. Philip Boykin is marvelous as the boatman. He really does a tremendous job there. And, you know, for all, Penny Fuller, oh, as the mother, just terrific beyond belief. Mm. For those who say, well, you know, it's done on the cheap, you got to admit that they have two soldiers where there used to be one soldier and a cutout. So they are paying an extra salary there. So I think it's certainly a difficult show for many people. And everybody gets very confused after the opening number of the second act when suddenly the world completely changes and we're brought up not quite up to date anymore. It's still 1984. It has to be, because we can't keep Marie, Dot's daughter, alive. We would never believe that she would now be 119. But but so 1984 is still when they're talking about. But challenging musical, yes, that's what Sondheim does. But if you want to see what I believe, he may refute it, is the one that means the most to him, do see it.
So I think, Peter, I think I heard all of our listeners make a collective gasp when you said that perhaps you've seen too many Sunday in the Parks with George. I'm just giving you a hard time.
No, it's fine. It's fine. Within the context of what I was saying, yes, I. In fact, I saw a marvelous high school production in November out in New Jersey, where Jackie Romano got that line, Louis blinks a bit and got a laugh out of it. So if she can do it, I don't see why Anna Lily Ashford cannot. But you know, let me ask you this, both of you. Something seemed new to me here, and maybe I've just missed the point all along. But the director, who is James Lapine's niece, Sanra is her name. So she gave Marie in the second act a Southern accent. And it makes so much sense to me because she establishes that when they left France, they went to South Carolina. So she was just a baby, and so she's heard Southern accents all her life. Am I correct? Did anybody ever I can't recall anybody doing it with a Southern accent before.
I think the first time I heard it was when Anna Lee Ashford did it at City Center. I don't
recall. Okay. All right. Yeah. So, yeah, this is a great idea. I mean, it's certainly good. I'm glad to hear that, because I was wondering, gee, did I miss that all along? Because I've seen Marianne Plunkett. I've seen Bernadette Peters, of course. Mm-hmm. I've seen Jenna Russell, and I don't recall anybody doing that. And you don't either.
Nope.
Okay, good.
No, that's a good point. So what can I say about this that you haven't already said? Last week when we talked about Sunset Boulevard and I talked about the amplification of the orchestra, I was interested again because this week seeing Sunday in the Park with the orchestra on stage and not quite as large as the orchestra of Sunset Boulevard, maybe half or a quarter of the number of I think it was 10 pieces on stage. Maybe it might have been more if either one of you know, chime in, for Sunday in the Park. But I thought the sound was great.
Okay.
And it didn't sound like it was amplified to me. Maybe it was amplified, but it didn't sound amplified, which is the key to, you know, great sound, is that you can't notice it. And I thought it was really wonderful and amazing. I lamented on Facebook that that I felt like a lot of Tony Awards are going to be missed because this production has decided not to make themselves Tony Award eligible. I felt like Anna Lee Ashford definitely would have been in contention, if not won the award. Walked away.
It's going to be hard in that category, James.
Well, but I see your point.
Yeah.
I completely agree with you that for a nomination, she was. Mm-hmm. And I'm just basing it on City Center. I thought she was absolutely fantastic.
I mean, and Liz McCartney and Brooksis Manschkis for supporting, and lighting design. That's all I'll, you know, just as Peter mentioned before, if I were the lighting designers, I'd be kind of angry that I'd be not walking up on stage in June. So I thought it was really, really wonderful. A great production, a must see. It's unfortunate it's such a limited run. I also think that if, in fact, they were Tony Award eligible and they were to win a handful of awards, including Best Revival, that they could have survived extending this show without Jake Gyllenhaal. And I think that that's a shame that they're not even going to attempt to go on, because there's a lot of people that want to see this. Tickets are absurdly expensive for this limited run, which is running through April 23rd. And they keep on saying that they cannot extend, they cannot extend. So evidently, it's going to be a hard stop on April 23rd, and you got to get down to see it. I mean, I paid $300-some-odd for my ticket from the box office, not a scalper.
Not with fees. Not with fees or with scalping, yeah.
It was $259 plus fees. So
okay.
Something like that. And I think that that's unfortunate for folks who are devotees of Stephen Sondheim and various other folks who are involved with this production. I think it's really wonderful. I think it would have won a ton of awards. Not that awards define it, but I think that the awards would help it be more of a commercial success and let it extend beyond this April 23rd deadline that they have self-imposed. You know, if you can get down and see it, see it. I think that they have a rush policy. The first two rows, I think, are $40 tickets or something like that. So if you can't quite get out there and spend the fortune for the tickets that others are, maybe the $40 tickets are something that can be available to you. All right. So next up. Michael got down to Second Stage to see Man from Nebraska. So why don't you tell us about that, Michael?
This is a play by Tracy Letts, most famous for August Osage County. This is not a new play. It was originally done in 2003 at Steppenwolf in Chicago. But this is its New York debut at Second Stage. Significant that it's off Broadway, not on Broadway. But, you know, that says a lot about Broadway, I guess, more than anything. Directed by David Cromer, wonderful cast. Reed Burney in the central role. Also Heidi Harmbruster, Tom Bloom, Anika Boris, Nana Mensa, Max Gordon Moore, Annette O'Toole as Reed's wife, Kathleen Pierce, and William Ragsdale. And basically, it's a play about a fellow from Nebraska who suddenly has a crisis of faith is, I guess, what you'd call it. He is a late middle-aged fellow who seems to be going through his routine with his wife, going to church, et cetera. And then one night he just starts crying, just weeping copiously, disconsolately. And his wife says, "What's wrong?" And he says, "I don't think I believe in God anymore." And so then we see what happens to him after that. He gets advice from the pastor, played by William Ragsdale, and he winds up taking a solo trip to England just to, I guess, hopefully clear his head. But there were a lot of wonderful moments in the play, but I also was not sure what the focus was. It seemed like it I didn't understand what exactly we're supposed to think happens to him. When he goes to England, he falls in with a woman who's a bartender in the hotel that he's staying at, and her boyfriend, who's a sculptor, and the sculptor prevails upon Ken Carpenter, that's Reed Burney's character's name, to try his hand at it, and so he does. And there's a theme of him trying to tap into his creativity for his first time in his life, and maybe see God that way. There's also an interesting thing that happens at the end, towards the end of the play, in regard to Ken's mother, played very beautifully by Kathleen Pierce, who is very, very old and not well in some kind of a nursing home or facility. There's something that happens with her that relates to his view of God and whether or not there is one. I don't want to say too much more than that. I do not think that the play is as successful overall as some of Tracy Lett's later work, including August Osage County. I also thought that that in this case, Mr. Cromer had maybe too heavy a hand in terms of the direction. And I kind of felt that there were many places where the silences were too long extended. And I understand the point of it. I really do. But there has to be a limit to that kind of thing. And I think that damaged the forward motion of the play. But certainly worth seeing, especially with a cast like that. Reed Birney in the past several years has become recognized as one of our greatest character actors. Mm-hmm. And he won a Tony for The Humans, mm-hmm. and he's just as good in this. So it would be worth it seeing, if only for him, but there's much more to it than that. Annette O'Toole, I have not seen on stage too often. She's superb in it. And everyone on stage is just great. So so that's Man from Nebraska at Second Stage.
All right, that's playing through March 26th, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. Peter got down to the Sheen Center where he saw Nine Circles. So Peter, tell us about that.
Nine Circles certainly rates at least a 9 out of 10 on the scale of what's good, because, a very, 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 very powerful play. I don't know if you know about the Sheen Center, you listeners out there. It's just down the street from the Lynn Redgrave Theater across the street. And it's doing some nice things there. I've certainly seen a bunch of things there, and I'm very impressed by the programming that goes on there, the people who choose to rent it. I'll say she is. The Marx Brothers musical even started there. So this is a play by Bill Kane, who did stand-up tragedy many years ago, and now we're talking about the war in Iraq. And, of course, obviously, this is going to be a very tough play if we're talking about the war in Iraq. But it turns out to be tougher in a much stranger way, because we don't see anything involving Iraq whatsoever. It's not that type of play. What we're really seeing is the ramifications after a guy has done a terrible thing over there. I don't want to say what he's done, but it's terrible, to the point of which he may very well get the death sentence. Don't be surprised if he does. And because he really comes from a background where masculinity meant being very warlike and not thinking about anything but killing the enemy, he's inured to it, let's say, from an early age. Now, I was a little worried at the beginning because it's established that he's a high school dropout from Texas. And I thought, I wish that he weren't Southern, and because the cliche is that this is what happens to people down there. And I don't think that's really something that we should be saying. I think that's really unfair to just categorize Southern people. What's wonderful is that while he's ignorant, he's not stupid. And we really get the impression that if this young man had really had the education, he could have really amounted to something. But because he did not get the education that he needed, he really turned out to be the way that he turned out. So very, very wonderful writing by Bill Kane in making us care about this guy who we didn't think we'd care about when the play started. Beautifully played, phenomenally played by Josh Collins, who I hope is remembered at awards time. I hope everybody who's any type of nominator gets down there to see this performance, because it is remarkable. So is everybody else in the play, because there are lawyers who come in, a female lawyer played by Ryman Sneed and a male lawyer, Aaron Roman Wiener, and they are there to do their job. They don't like him. They don't like what he says. Part of the times he says, I want to die. What do I care. You know, it doesn't matter. You know, who am I? You know, I don't. And so they say, no, you have to defend yourself. I mean, that's the way it goes. It is my job to defend you. I'm going to do the best I can to defend you. Let's see how we can get you at least not get a death sentence. But no. It's he doesn't play ball with them at all. And getting through to him is not an easy thing. And of course, there's also a chaplain type figure played wonderfully again by David St. Louis, who does a tremendous job of trying to get through him through religion, and that's even less successful than the lawyers. The final scene, how can I talk about it without giving anything away? Just let me say the final scene, which is about 4 or 5 minutes with him on stage alone, harrowing beyond belief, as wonderful as he's been throughout the entire play. He is even more spectacular now. So this is really quite an event. It's 95 minutes, no intermission. And it really had a rather full house, by the way, which was really pretty impressive for a tough play like this. A lot of people just don't want to be reminded of this situation, of these situations. And they stay away from plays like this. But they were there that night. And boy, you could really feel the collected intake of breath and holding of breath as this play was unfolding. So if you have the stomach for it, if you have the mind for it, get down to the Sheen Center and see Bill Kane's Nine Circles.
Okay. So Nine Circles is playing through March 19th, and we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well. So, Michael, you got over to Signature Theater where you saw a production of Everybody. So tell us about that.
Everybody by Brandon Jacobs Jenkins is a modern adaptation of the very, very old morality play Every Man. And there's a tremendous amount of creativity involved here, including a gimmick, if I may use that word. Let's see. There are 9 actors in the play. And of those, the only people who play one role, the same role every night at every performance, are Jocelyn Bio as Usher, God and Understanding, Mary Louise Burke as Death, Liliana Tierra Cornell, a wonderful young actress, as Girl / Time, and Chris Perfetti as Love. The others come out of at the start of the show, everyone is seated in the audience of these other characters. Brooke Bloom, Michael Braun, Louis Cancelmi, David Patrick Kelly, Lakeisha Michelle May. And they are everybody. They are us. We are all every man. So that's why they're seated literally in the audience, in regular seats among the audience. And then they come forward, and then they don't draw straws. They do that thing where it's like a lottery, where there are little balls in a little cage that gets rotated, and they pick whatever ball, and according to what it says on it, they play the various roles that night. So someone of those people is going to play every man or everybody, excuse me, and whether it be a male or a female. And then the others play. The plot is that every man or everybody is summoned by God God sends death to summon every man to he's going to die, and he has to account for himself. And everybody tries to get something to accompany him in death. So he goes he goes to his relatives, he goes to his friends, he appeals to his beauty and all the aspects of his life, but nobody, personified, obviously, no one will come with him until finally Love, in this case, it's called Love, played by Chris Perfetti, agrees to come with him. I think in the original play, it's called Good Works. So it's implied that that's what follows us to our death, good works. In this adaptation, Love does in fact climb into the grave with everybody, but so does this other character personifying all the shitty evil things that he has done in his life. So that is a major, major difference from the original play, as I understand it. But just logistically, the fact that all of these actors have to memorize every single line of the play and be able to play any of those roles at a moment's notice, it's really quite something. So I think people will find it interesting in that respect alone. I think they might have made it much easier on themselves if everybody character was also the same person every night, but they didn't do that. I was lucky enough to see Lewis Cancelmi, and he's just one of my favorite actors, so I loved it for that. I thought there was a lot of thoughtful writing in it, which is not surprising from Brandon Jacobs Jenkins. I also thought there was a lot of there was, again, a lack of focus as to exactly what the main issues are. At one point, race came up, and I thought, that's fine, but it didn't really seem to have anything to do with this story. And then there were lots of other tangents, other things that didn't seem to have to do with the main plot. So I think it could be worked, like Kid Victory, I think it could be worked on a little more and improved. But as it is, it's definitely worth seeing. And David Patrick Kelly is someone I also always love seeing on stage. And Mary Louise Burke is always marvelous. So directed by Lila Neugebauer, by the way, at Signature. And it's definitely worth your while.
All right. So that also is playing through March 19th. It's a very popular cutoff date. March 19th seems to be four or five shows that we're talking about this morning are ending that day. Peter got down to Brooklyn to see The Skin of Our Teeth at Theater for a New Audience. So tell us about your trip.
I met a young reader in the lobby who told me that she had never seen The Skin of Our Teeth, didn't know anything about it, apparently liked Our Town and Matchmaker enough to go. And I said, well, you're in for a wild and woolly ride. There's no question about that, because Skin of Our Teeth is not like those other plays. I guess it's a second cousin to Our Town because it plays a great deal with time and space. But it is a difficult play for many people. And the joke was, not joke, the reality was, when it was first produced at the theater where we'll soon see War Paint, the cab drivers used to show up at about 9:15 every night, because shows started at 8:30, and they knew a lot of people would be walking out before the second act was to start, because it's a confusing play. It's an allegory. It deals with all of us. In fact, All About Us was the name that Kandra Nebb chose for a while for their musical version of The Skin of Our Teeth, which is yet to be seen in New York and probably won't be, because the Thornton Wilder estate is a little touchy about certain things. It's the story of man. We're dealing with Mr. Antrobus, who really represents every man from way back when, and he's just invented the wheel. He lives in Excelsior, New Jersey, and he's been married. He has two kids, though, as well as the lines of dialogue goes, we've always had two kids, but they haven't always been the same two kids, because one of them, now called Henry, used to be called Cain, and he killed his brother Abel. That's been a problem, and then the mother hasn't gotten over that. The mother, played by Keisha Lewis, is extraordinary. Extraordinary. One of the great performances of the season. She has to play really an earth mother. She also has to contend with Sabina, who's eccentrically played, and that's not a criticism. This is an eccentric role. Mary Wiseman plays it. The maid in the house. And she's also been the father's lover. But as Mrs. Antrobus says, you didn't last. In other words, the fact is that in life, wives tend to have more staying power than mistresses. And that's the way Thornton Wilder believed in family values, we can see as a result of this play. So the second act deals with with Noah's flood. They have to prepare for that. And the third act deals with after a big war. And don't forget, that was still raging when this play was first produced in the early 40s. So the point is that we always get by the skin of our teeth. Now, the question becomes, you know, theater for a new audience here. You know, you really have to wonder if Jeffrey Horowitz, the artistic director, knew and agreed with Michael Moore, the filmmaker, who kept on predicting a Trump win, because, boy, does this play seem relevant now. And we have to hope that we do get by the skin of our teeth, considering what's going on. So many of the lines really refer to matters that are going on today. The audience really gave out with a jaded laugh very early on when there's a question, because we're dealing with the Ice Age in the first act, whether or not they should take in people outside who are literally called refugees. Should we take them in? So that's just one of the examples of many lines that will resonate with today. Again, Thornton Wilder did it in our town. He made a play that deals with now and forever, and so is the case in this one, too, even though this one's funkier. The world is not actually coming to an end is a line, and we hope that's right. Give the whole thing up, somebody says at one point, because, you know, what's the point of going on? Well, no, we have to go on. We have to go on. So what's always fun in a situation like this is to hear some line that in 1942 people hoped would be true that didn't turn out to be. So and that happens in the second act when you hear somebody say the common cold is being pursued, the cure for the common cold. So we still haven't got it all these years later. So Wilder's optimism there hasn't come true yet. But I tell you, this Aaron Arbus, who directs and often directs out there, directs for this company, I think is one of our major directors. Certainly the style with which she puts things on stage, the stage pictures are glorious. There's a very simple set, very simple, that works wonderfully. And this lady has an eye, I'm telling you. And whenever I find out that she's directing a show, I am raring to go, because I know she's not going to disappoint me. She never disappoints me, and she always does spectacular work. This is a play that also demands a great number of people. There's a possibility that that all the shows on 48th Street don't have as many people in it as you see in this cast. A lot of people are needed for the skin of our teeth. And they really broke the budget on actors. I imagine some of them are like supernumeraries in opera, but still, I'm telling you, there are a lot of bodies on the stage, and there are a lot of people who had to be costumed, and there are a lot of funky costumes, including one for a mammoth, including one for a dinosaur. I told you it's a strange play. It's a strange play. But if you're ever inclined to see The Skin of Our Teeth, which isn't produced often because it's expensive to do, now's the time. Get to Brooklyn. I do urge you, if you're going to take the subway, to go on a weekday, because the D train gets so funky on weekends now. But it can be arrived there by the 2 train going to Nevin Street. But give yourself a lot of time, because that turns out to be local on weekends. Took me forever to get there, but boy, was it worth the trip.
I'm so happy to hear that about the cast. I mean, you know, you can certainly conceive of a modern production saying, oh, well, you know, we don't really need all those people. We'll just do a lot of doubling. And that would be disastrous for this particular play.
Yeah, I did see a production in New Jersey about 10 years ago where they scrimped on the cast. And frankly, it didn't bother me as much as I feared it would. And yes, this is the way Wilder would have liked it done. I don't think he would have liked to hear the word frickin' thrown into the dialogue at one point. There has been so be it. So be it. I understand where it's coming from, because when this play was originally done in 41 or so, Sabina was the maid was complaining about they don't write plays like they used to, which is what, of course, we all do. And why don't we have plays like Smiling Through? You know, well, that doesn't mean anything today. So it's always fun to see what three shows are chosen to replicate, to indicate, that theater was better than it used to be. And I imagine Aaron Arbus is the one who came up with the three that are quite funny in this one.
So the Theater for a New Audience, don't be intimidated that it's in Brooklyn. It's smack right in the heart of the BAM district. So if you have gotten out to BAM, you can easily get out to Theater for the New Audience.
Yeah, right down the street from the Harvey Theater. Right, yeah. Really. I mean, like probably 300 steps.
Lots of really nice restaurants right around there.
There are.
All right. So Peter and Michael got a chance to see The View upstairs. We're running really tight for time. So what have you got to say about The View upstairs?
Peter, you want to go first?
Oh, Peter, I'm sorry. Yeah.
Sure, why not? The View Upstairs, a new musical by Max Vernon. He did it all. And as it turns out, it deals with a real-life incident that happened in 1973 in New Orleans, where a patron was denied entrance to a gay bar. We don't know why. And supposedly, never proved, but set fire to the place, and a lot of people died. And most interestingly, a lot of bodies were unclaimed because young men in there, their parents didn't want to admit that their children were actually in a gay bar. Imagine what a disgrace that would be. So a lot of bodies got buried in a potter's field. So here we are in this nightclub, and there's a great deal of talk about how we all have to stick together, and because these are tough times. 1973, yes, Stonewall has happened, but it's not as if on June 30th, 1969, the world immediately changed. So a lot of people in here who want to be themselves are very scared of being themselves outside, and this is their one enclave where they can be themselves and enjoy themselves. The strange thing is, it starts out today, and a young man is buying the place. He wants to do something with it, and the ghosts of everybody show up. I don't know why this device was necessarily needed. Sure, to show the differences in how far gay people have come in being accepted between now and then. It isn't mined enough. Every now and then today's young man will say something that certainly indicates the times have changed and times have changed for the better. Though this play has been rewritten recently because there are at least three references to Trump and what could happen under the circumstances that we all have to be a little worried. I mean, if I may get political here for a second, it did occur to me with this thing this week about transgender. I thought, yeah. Very smart of them. Start with the transgender, because that's still the issue that freaks out a lot of people.
Exactly.
And therefore, you know, we'll start with that. And once we get that accomplished, then we'll move on. It's a variation of, and then they came for me.
Exactly.
So, yeah, you see it that way too, Michael.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah.
Yes.
So, there are references to that. They're not ashamed or afraid to bring that up right here and now. Some nice music, some solid lyrics, some imperfect rhymes. All in all, a semi-success. It never, to me, packs the wallop that I wanted it to. Very flamboyantly played by everybody on there. I got a lot of tremendous laughs from the audience, and who really enjoyed seeing the drag queens do their thing, and the tough lesbian bartender, et cetera, et cetera. So the types you expect to see in a gay bar are certainly there, and you can't quarrel with the way that they've been portrayed. And there's a hustler in there too, and whether or not the hustler and our visitor from our stranger from a strange land gets involved with him seems to me a detour of a story that isn't necessary. Still, a very entertaining piece down at the Lynn Redgrave Theater, which has really been very nicely appointed for the set, which is very real and very accurate for the era. So not a must-see. But if you wind up being there through a friend saying, hey, come with me, I don't think you'll feel you've wasted your time.
All right, Michael.
Yes, definitely the scenic design by Jason Sherwood and whoever was in charge of amassing a wonderful old props and set pieces, like there's an old jukebox and an old soda machine that has a sign on it that says out of order, drink beer. Mm-hmm. Which I thought was, did you see that?
No, yeah. No. I was almost sitting behind a pole, frankly. But anyway, go on.
Oh, yeah. There are issues from a few seats there because there are those huge posts in the Lynn Redgrave Theater. But I did think that Scott Ebersold made a conscious effort to keep the staging such that you wouldn't really miss anything for very long. I think the best thing about this piece is the music and lyrics by Max Vernon. I think there's a similarity to John Kander in that these are all new songs, but they sound very authentically early 70s. And again, I think that's a great, great talent. I was a little taken aback when we had Michael Longoria, who plays Freddie, this young drag queen performer, Latino drag queen performer, on the podcast last week. And we were talking, and when it was confirmed that they were all new songs, I was a little taken aback. I thought, well, you know, is that the best decision rather than to use actual songs of the period? But I think that it's a spectacular success here. The book I had quite a few problems with. I don't mind the time travel thing per se. In fact, I think it adds to it, especially there are some very, very spooky kind of sad moments when the modern day character Wes, played by Jeremy Pope, he first comes in, he's being shown the property by a realtor. And this is the bar, the upstairs lounge in New Orleans, where this horrendous fire had taken place decades earlier. So he's standing there. And when the lights go out, it really does look somehow it looks like, a desolate, burned out room. And that I think that really added to it a lot. And the way he goes back and tries to interacts with these ghosts of these people, there were some Follies aspects of it. So I didn't mind that at all. I just thought that some of the actual writing of the dialogue was unfortunately very clunky. I also didn't. I was going to say that I thought there were too many stereotypes, but as I think we made this point before. Stereotypes are stereotypes because people keep repeating them, and they must have some element of truth. Otherwise, people wouldn't do that. Sure. And especially in the gay world, in the early days, especially of the gay rights movement, there were people who would tend to fall into these specific categories of the hustler or the butch bartender or the drag queen. So I really don't think, although you may think, you may feel, oh, this is a little cliche and stereotype. I think you have to look at it in historical context. So I didn't mind that at all. I think that Max Vernon is a major voice in terms of composer and lyricist. And perhaps, I guess I would suggest that in future he might find a book writer to collaborate with at least. I think that would be a very excellent idea.
All right. So The View Upstairs is playing at the Lynn Redgrave Theater on Bleecker Street. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. So, Michael, you got over to the Metropolitan Opera where you saw Werther.
This might be one of the hardest things to pronounce because it's based on a novel by Goethe called The Sorrows of Young... Well, I think the German pronunciation would be Werther. But the opera is in French by Massenet, and so it's pronounced Werther. Just briefly, it may be the greatest opera about unrequited love. The central character is a poet named Werther, and he is desperately in love with a woman named, you'll be happy to know, James, Charlotte. That is pronounced here as Charlotte, because that would be the French pronunciation. I'm not sure what the German pronunciation would be. But he doesn't know initially that she is engaged to another fellow. He's not aware of this, and he only becomes aware of it at the end of the first act, where we see that he's already become completely smitten with her. So this becomes an issue. And, you know, that's interesting in itself. But what makes it more interesting is that the fellow that Charlotte winds up marrying, Albert, he is a friend of Werther, and he's very sympathetic to Werther's situation and being desperately in love with his wife. So it's not, you know, it's not cut and dried. It's not like the husband is, oh, you can't, you know, we can't have this person in our life anymore, and we have to cut him out, and you can never see him again. It's not that at all. They kind of try to make it work and maintain the friendship, but eventually it just becomes too much for Werther, and he kills himself. So it's a very sad opera with some of the most beautiful music ever written by Jules Massenet, and the cast in this case was incredible. It was Vittorio Grigolo as Werther and Isabel Leonard as Charlotte, and Albert was David Bizek. This, by the way, is a new production directed by Sir Richard Eyre, set and costume design Rob Howell, lighting design Peter Mumford, video design Wendell K. Harrington, choreographer Sarah Erd. Lovely, lovely production. And the other interesting name thing for this opera is that the role of Charlotte's younger sister, Sophie, was sung in this case by a wonderful young soprano, and her name is Anna Christie. So I thought that was kind of cute, although she spells it differently. It's C-H-R-I-S-T-Y. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you know, not an opera that's seen as often as Aida or Carmen or La Boheme, but it's really just gorgeous. I think maybe one of the reasons it's not done more often is it's so sad. It's so, so sad, but incredibly beautiful. So I would really check it out if you have an opportunity to do so.
Okay, so we'll have a link to that in the show notes as well for the Metropolitan Opera website, which I sound like a broken record, but is beautiful.
And by the way, the Met has announced its upcoming season, and Kelly O'Hara, who has already made her, you know her, who has already made her debut there in The Merry Widow, but now will I guess, be singing her first role in an actual old-school Italian, it's actually Così fan tutte, which is by Mozart, but that one is written in Italian, and so she's going to be playing Despina in that. So that should be very, very newsworthy, to say the least.
So between Light in the Piazza and the Bridges of Madison County, she's got that Italian thing down pretty well.
Yeah. Well, apparently this production of Così fan tutte is going to be set in Coney Island in the 1950s. So I think there's going to be plenty of opportunity for interesting costuming.
Good Italian restaurants there that maybe Karen Mason worked at. Michael, you also got over to the memorial for Florence Henderson. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yes, it was at the Music Box on Tuesday the 21st, and it was put together by her family, and it was a beautiful, tribute to her life and her work with copious clips. The guests, speakers and performers included Alan Cumming, Michael Feinstein, Whoopi Goldberg, Cheetah Rivera, Glenn Rovin, James Snyder, Bruce Valanche, and Barry Williams, a.k.a. Greg from the Brady Bunch, hosted by Judy Gold. Very well put together. Glenn Rovin was the music director. I think that equal weight was given to Florence's several careers, her Broadway career, her TV career, not only as on the Brady Bunch, but her commercials for Wesson, et cetera. There were lots of clips of that. And there was even a clip from the movie of Song of Norway, which I have never seen, and I really have to catch up with that. So,
oh, you think so, huh? All right.
Well, I mean, just
I know.
Yeah. No, I know. It's I'm aware. It's mm-hmm. it's not considered. But and also this opera singer named Pretty Yende sang "You'll Never Walk Alone," I guess, to celebrate the more operatic style singing that Florence could do so well. And it was supposed to have been Isabel Leonard, whom I had seen and heard the night before in Werther, but I don't know, maybe they didn't realize she'd be singing the night before and they didn't want to do that. Anyway, I'm really glad I went. I don't always get to go to these public memorials, but this one was, I had interviewed Florence several times and I thought she was an amazing, amazing woman. And I'm very sorry for her loss, but she will live on and on DVD and Blu-ray and CD and MP3 and all of that stuff.
Okay, so before we wrap up for the day and get to trivia, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. There's a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically added to iTunes for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us in iTunes. You can listen to us in many ways. One of the ways is iHeartRadio, which streams us 24/7. Google Play, the Google Play podcast store also has us. And we have a new way you can reach us. If you have an Amazon Echo, you can play us on TuneIn, which is the Amazon radio station. And we can be found on TuneIn. So you can just say, Alexa, play Broadway Radio for us. You can probably find our podcast that way as well. We can also be found on the Stitcher app and Broadway World Radio places Wednesdays at noon, Thursdays at 7 p.m., and Saturdays at 2 p.m. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today, can be found at Broadway Radio as well. So, Peter, you have an answer to last week's trivia.
Yes, and this actually gets more interesting than I had initially thought, as we will discuss. The question was, what major featured character in a 1960s musical shares a surname with a minor featured character in a 90s musical? And the answer is Sheldrake, who in Promises, Promises is the bad guy, basically, the one who's having an affair with Frank Kubelik, and that leads to all kinds of unhappiness and things of that sort. But then Sheldrake is also the name of the producer in Sunset Boulevard, whom Joe Gillis is dealing with or trying to deal with or trying not to deal with. And I did not make the connection when I asked this question that both Promises, Promises and Sunset Boulevard are based on previous works that were co-written by Billy Wilder. And Peter Felicia was kind enough to point out to me that apparently those are not the only two cases in which Wilder used that surname for a character.
No. Just as Carol Burnett loved pulling her ear at the end of every episode of her show, and Sheldrake was a thing that I don't know if it meant anything to Billy Wilder, if he knew somebody along the way by that name, but it does show up in a number of his pictures, including a very underrated film, as I feel, Kiss Me Stupid, which, yeah, the title doesn't suggest it's going to be very good. I remember watching it and saying, my God, this is an Italian farce, and only then realizing that it was actually in the credits established that it was based on an Italian farce. And yet, at the end of this picture, see if you don't have tears in your eyes, because everybody gets what he wants. And that's what's so wonderful about it. But Sheldrake is in there, too. I'm telling you, he just loved this name. And if there are any Billy Wilder scholars out there who know why, I'd love to hear why he was attracted to this name. So, yeah. So my question, what composer never won a Pulitzer Prize, but worked on musicals with four people, each of whom had already won one by the time they started collaborating? So I want to know who's the composer and who are the four Pulitzer winners.
Okay, if you have an answer to that, email us at trivia@broadwayradio.com and we'll let you know if you're on the right track. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Ordinary magic happens every single day. Wonder.
wonder.